Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to Virtues of Peace. My name is Hope Elizabeth May. I am joined by Taylor Ackerman.
Hello.
Michael Buzzy.
Hello, everyone.
And Randy Olson.
It's good to be back.
Yeah, we had a small hiatus. We didn't have a show last week. We are back today on August 27th, 2020, and this is an important day of remembrance. Because today is the day, actually I must confess that in my research I found, this is not exactly great reporting, but some say August 25th, some say August 27th, but in any case, for the peace flag, those two dates are given. The peace flag, which we'll be talking about today, or also known as the International Banner of Peace, was adopted around this time by the first peace organization called the Universal Peace Union, and that was in 1897, and also the Kellogg-Briand Pact, which was an international treaty outlawing war, August 27th, 1928. And then tomorrow is the 107th anniversary of the opening of the Peace Palace and the 57th anniversary of the I Have a Dream speech. All of these different moments are important links in this thread of peace history that we try to uncover, excavate, and bring to consciousness. And today we are talking about visualizing the importance of visual objects, and in particular, the peace flag and the peace palace, the role that they play in the peace through law movement. So this is really about concretization of moments, of ideas, of concepts to make them visible to the eye. And I want to begin by just reminding our listeners of the very first show of the Virtues of Peace prong, which is really part of this larger effort called Ethics Talk. But the Virtues of Peace trail, if you will, was launched on May 18th of this year. And May 18th, that's going to come up later on in the show. I just want to sort of mark it again. That was the original Peace Day, very much connected to both the peace flag and the Peace Palace. But I just wanted to sort of highlight that show, that you may want to listen to that show, even again if you've already listened to it, because in that show, which is with Randy and myself, we define peace, and we discuss a little bit about the work of Cora de Bratsop, not so much about the peace flag, but about the Universal Peace Badge, which is connected to the flag, that may come up again. And we also mentioned this concept, the dignity of continuity. And this goes back to this idea of today's show, which is there's this thread, and as one of the activists says, that in 1893, I think it is, that we have to a sort of duty to remember the dignity of continuity of this thread of effort. Otherwise, this work is going to continue in a, quote, series of unrelated spasms. So rather than being part of a continuous effort. So all of that is discussed on our May 18th show. I just flag it. And also May 18th should come up again today. So we'll reinforce some of the things we said there, maybe. But to begin, let's talk about the peace flag. So it's created in 1897. You can read more about it at our show resources page. You can see a picture of it at our show resources page. There's also the graphic on Blog Talk Radio. That colorful object is on top of the Peace Palace. That is the International Banner of Peace. So to help us understand the symbolism, Randy, what can you tell us about the symbolism of the peace flag?
So there's a handful of different ways to enter this mini forest, but before I do, I wanted to draw one more link to this this thread before I dive in, because you know yesterday was the 100-year anniversary of the constitutional amendment that gave or prohibited the discrimination against or the prohibit the prohibit oh my god it allowed women to vote in the United States. My words aren't coming
right. All women.
I want them to. So. All, yeah, you can't discriminate based on sex, and that's now a constitutional law thanks to an enormous effort that culminated 100 years ago yesterday. So I just wanted to tie that in because it's going to be relevant to almost everything
cool.
we talk about today.
And if I could please add, because connected to that is a monument that went up yesterday in Central Park. And so going back, like this is going to connect. So I just want to say yesterday on this historic day, the 100th anniversary of when the Constitution is actually amended. So Tennessee ratified it on August 18th. The paperwork had to be put on a train to D.C. And the Secretary of State like did all the formal business on August 26th. And technically that is when the Constitution evolved to allow all women the right to vote. But yesterday, to mark that moment, they placed a statue, and it's very similar to what's we're going to talk about with the Peace Palace. And Taylor, you were there, you know, 7 years ago in The Hague with me as part of this moment, and I think that's really important. But so what they did in Central Park is unveil the first ever statue of real women. So like Mother Goose is in Central Park, and Alice in Wonderland, and some nymphs and fairies. Same thing with the Peace Palace 7 years ago. There were no actual women. So Bertha von Suttner was the first woman to be put in 7 years ago when the Peace Palace turned 100 on August 28th. And so yesterday, on the 100th anniversary of the 19th Amendment, the first ever actual statue of actual women goes up in Central Park. I'll put the link on the show resources page to the organization responsible for this, which is called Monumental Women, and they've been working on it for 7 years. So it's so interesting that they began working on that in 2013 as Bertha was being unveiled by Lama Bowie in the Peace Palace, and we'll come to that at the end of the show. But the three women are Susan B. Anthony, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, and Sojourner Truth, an African-American suffragist, really important to the movement. So awesome. Okay. Take it away.
All right. So back to the flag. So there's this idea of visual symbolism that's going to run underneath all of what we talk about today. And the first major version of that, first big item, is the peace flag. So there's some elements to the flag that have some significance that I'm going to unpack. The first of which is, like, there's three main colors on the flag, right?
Mm-hmm.
So closest to the flagpole part, there's a yellow strip. And then in the middle, there's a purple strip. And on the right side, there's a white strip. And they're not arbitrary. So first of all, the colors are chosen because there isn't a national flag that has these colors, or wasn't at the time. And the idea was it's not going to be possible to confuse this flag with any particular nation's flag. Now, the colors then get another layer of abstraction up, and it's like the yellow is representing the symbolic masculine that's packaged into humanity, the purple is representing the symbolic feminine, and then the white is representing this the spirit of peace within all people. And, you know, this is, I guess, an old version of gender. We could get into a conversation about that.
Mm-hmm.
But at the time, the whole point was men and women working together. And not just men and women, but, like, the divine form of masculinity and the divine form of femininity coming together with the spirit that holds things together as the symbol, right? So this is just the raw template. that's like the main things. And then in the center of the flag, inside of the purple strip, there is another symbol, and it's a very complicated symbol. So it would help if, you know, if you check out the show resources page, you pull it up, it'll probably make more sense when you look at it. But basically, there's a shield. And at the top of the shield, there's two hands holding, there's two hands that are clasped together. One's a hand of a man, one's a hand of a woman, and there's wings attached to those hands. So the idea is men and women need to work together in order to uplift humanity, something like that. Now there are those wings are lifting up towards a star. Now, we could talk about that in a bunch of different ways, but the way I think about it that's useful for me is there's an ideal upon which when people work together, when men and women work together, they uplift towards the ideal. So that's one interpretation of that. Now, in the center of the shield, there's a peace dove with an olive branch. The symbol of a dove and peace is a complicated symbol for why that's represented that way. Just for now, assume peace dove, those things being linked together. And then at the bottom, the actual label for the symbol says pro concordia labor. Now, that means I work for peace, or I work for harmony technically, but I work for peace and I work for harmony are in, at least in this symbol, meant to be interchangeable. So I think that's a good starting spot, right? So we have some symbolic ideas packaged into an image. The image is put onto a concrete item that is then used in various ways. Now, flags are not just any symbol. The whole point of a flag is that you're supposed to put it up into the air and let it fly in the wind. So why, right? One of the things is you have to look up in order to see a flag flying in the wind, right? So it's like when a person looks up and sees this image above them, the whole concept of personal identification with the part that has to do the elevating, the uplifting, in order to reach that ideal, which is packaged into the symbol, becomes part of the individual during the experience of looking at it. So it's like one of these multi-layered embodied experiences that the people who are creating these symbols and creating these items for the purposes of like concretizing our memory about them had in mind. They're, like, these are very intelligent people who thought about this stuff very hard. And so I think I'll pause with that because there's a lot in there, and I'll double back in a bit, but all right. For now, that's the flag. That's some symbolism in it.
Yeah, and I want to add that this flag was created again. This flag was created in 1897. So this, and out of need. And if you go to our show resources page and look at the brochure, it says something, or it's on the website as well. If you don't look at the brochure, there was a flag created, a peace flag, by Henri Petit, I think in 1891. But it was deemed to be an inadequate symbol because it was simply his device, if you will, was to take a white flag and to write the word peace on it and then to put the nation, your nation's flag inside of the white portion of the flag. So it would, in effect, be a country's flag on a white background with the word peace on it. And the designers of this, so that's 1891, and that was seen to be an inferior device because what was needed was a single image and one that did not evoke any sense of nationalism or remind oneself of any specific nation. So the colors were chosen because they're not used by any nation to this day. Purple, yellow, and white are not used by any country in their national flag. And the other thing I want to say is that if you look at the original, so if you go to the show resources page, I hope I'm remembering this correctly, but the or even if you go to the Blog Talk Radio page and you look at the image that we have there for this show, it's the Peace Palace, and then to the right is the peace flag. But if you look on that, there's no dove and olive branch in it. It's blank, okay? So the dove and olive branch comes from the Women's Christian Temperance Union, actually. Their flag is in an archive, and you can see it, and it's actually the colors are in the wrong order. But on the original materials, it says, you know, you're supposed to put your own society's motto, like, in that blank shield. So it's blank, but indeed, some of the flags that have been, you know, transmitted to us have the dove and the olive branch on it. But the brochure itself says it's to be blank, and if you look at the image, the shield is blank. And that may be sort of continuing from the 1891 flag, where it was just you have this white background and you put your own country's flag in the middle. And so it's a similar idea, like you have this sort of space on the flag where you put your own identity, your own organization's symbol within this larger background symbol, which is nice because it's like e pluribus unum, right? So it's like you have this universal thing, but you have the individual somehow symbolized within it.
Yeah,
I
so
open it up to anyone.
Building on
so
that
ahead.
A little bit more.
Yep.
Like, so at the time, there was a number of symbols that had grown in the collective consciousness of society, such that people understood that symbol meant something specific. And the easy example for this is the Red Cross, right? So, you know, Henry Dunant and Clara Barton and others created this single symbol that would represent medical treatment in general, which then when flown, people understood, okay, like in times of war, for example, right? When you see a Red Cross structure, you know that's a hospital. And there's a power to that. That's like, okay, that's what that means, and everybody becomes aware that that's what that structure is, or that's what that organization is about. And at the time, the peace movement needed something like that, because the peace movement was this—it's this idea that has so many different components to it, and uniting all of those under a single banner is a—it's a lofty ideal, but it's. That's the whole point. It's this idea that, okay, we're going to weave together all the organizations and all of the movements and all of the work that's working specifically towards trying to make a more peaceful world. And so that's why the 1980 or 1891 symbol wasn't enough, because it's like it's not mainly peace. It's mainly the nation's flag with a little amendment around it versus here's big peace flag. Most of the symbolism is going to stay constant. And then, as you mentioned, there's, you know, there's this weird need to be able to customize and personalize your commitment in the actual symbol. But the main, like the bulk of the symbol, so to speak, doesn't change. And the same, you know, just imagine the Red Cross, right? Most of the time when you see a Red Cross, it's just the Red Cross. And then sometimes there's an organization's name under it or who knows, but things along that line, like the idea is you need a big symbol in order to capture an idea. And then the idea can move around faster than the symbol can, and we can all begin to see the world in the same way, which is in no small way how culture grows and transforms.
Cool. Anybody want to add or... I have a question, comment.
I was just going to point, at least from my own personal take on it, I just love how broad and yet individualistic the flag is itself. Like Randy was talking about, there's this inherent need to have you know, the symbol that you can sort of project the peace movement onto, risen high, that people can identify with. But yet it also has that really individualistic component with even the pro Concordia labor phrase, I work for peace or something along those lines. And then as well with, if it were to be left blank, that the nationality or whatever could implant their own sort of peace onto it as well. But even, and that's a powerful sense too. Like Randy was saying that this whole, like 99% of the flag is, you know, remaining constant and is this call to peace, whereas then it will envelop your national symbol. I thought that was really profound.
Mm-hmm. Cool. And Taylor, anything about the flag?
Yeah, I think, I mean, just briefly, I'd mentioned, like, with the gender component, I think it's so interesting and should always be, like, noted about the fact that, you know, the peace movement and the women's rights movement really were symbiotic in the early 20th century and throughout. And, like, and that's a whole other conversation, a whole other podcast. But to me, I think that's, like, the most when I look at the symbolism of the flag, like, I see the idea about of the peace movement needing all the gender, all the genders and all of the different attributes of each person individually across the world to make it work together. I think, like, that to me has always struck me as the most important, or not maybe the most important, but the most tangible sort of outcome when I look at the peace movement, the program for the labor flag.
So there, and what's so fascinating, so going back to August 26th, which we talked about when the 19th Amendment is ratified, if you should happen to see pictures of the unveiling yesterday, or if you should happen to see video of when President Trump pardoned Susan B. Anthony, because he did pardon Susan B. Anthony, who was arrested for voting, you'll see people wearing sashes of purple, yellow, and white. The statue itself that was unveiled in Central Park was covered in a purple silk sheet, and they pulled that away. And in 1913, the National Woman's Party adopted a flag, and the colors were the same colors with the peace flag, not in the same order, but the same colors. And I've done quite a bit of research on, you know, is there like a concrete conscious transmission from the peace flag to the women who made the flag of the National Women's Party. And I'm not going to divulge what I've learned so far. I did write on it for the Sewall Belmont House, which I think that's now, you can only can access it through Wayback Machine. But that's another striking thing, right? That, so you have the clasped hands, which symbolizes like men and women, or as you say, like all parts of the person working on this goal. And that symbolizes the cooperation of these different parts of the person, or different people, if you will. But the colors themselves also are consciously used, maybe not by the National Women's Party, but definitely by the International Council of Women, which I hope we get to at the end of this show. But those colors help you to see that thread that you're talking about, Taylor, between the peace movement and the women's movement. Anything else on that
final
point? Go ahead. Yeah.
Yeah. One final stone to sort of anchor it as much as I know how. Like, you know, we're celebrating this on August 27th, right? And so this flag, it comes about on, you know, it's first unveiled on August 27th. At an organization meeting, the 31st annual convention of this organization called the Universal Peace Union. And, you know, there's a bunch to say about that organization, but the main thing to know about it is that it's this meeting, it's this hub for many different parts of the Reformation period, right? So before, at the like the early days of this organization were anti, or they were like abolitionist people who were there, right? So William Lloyd Garrison was one of the people who went to these conventions, right? So that's just a name, one of many, right? Frederick Douglass has been to this place. And then 30 years later, we have the women suffragist people here coming to this place, and there's a reason why, right? Now, we can talk about it over time, but for now, just know that it's called Mystic Grove, and you don't get to have a name like that without doing something amazing there. So, I mean, this place is, it's called, right, the Universal Peace Union, and it's a union of all these different organizations working for all these different components of society that all need to be improved. They're all part of the ideal that everyone's working towards, right? So peace is the big umbrella under which, you know, you can't have peace without having certain components of social justice in place. You can't have it without other kinds of things that are in motion, making the world a place where, which Jane Addams identified as like allowing for the unfoldment of the free and full development of the human personality. So society trying to make the best possible society out of what's already there. So taking what's there, realizing that there's a lot of things about society that are great, and then they're realizing there's a lot of things that aren't done yet and need to be improved. All of that is peace work. That's
awesome.
My final slab.
So, and I just want to say again, like, it might be August 25th. I should throw this up on the show resources page. It really does, like, around this time. But the Peace Flag brochure, which we, you know, found in an archive, says August 27th, 1897, but other newspapers report August 25th, 1897. Regardless, it's an important time, and they're like this theme of peace is this umbrella term, and there was an organization that was bringing all of these different other, like, smaller organizations together to meet and to discuss making the world a humane place. Which, and I should say, we haven't said the A word, which is arbitration. This was the sort of, like you mentioned, abolition, another A word, but arbitration and abolition, those, we really need to, like, link those two, because, like, the movement, if you will, like the very in vogue thing that all progressives were focusing their energies on, in addition to abolition, was arbitration, and that is providing a process for states to arbitrate, that is, discuss and hence nonviolently solve their problems instead of taking up arms and solving their problems that way. So this was the movement, and it really does start, like, it becomes even more powerful after the Civil War. So the Universal Peace Union, I think it's first organized in 1866, so right after the Civil War in the United States, and it was like, never again, you know, let's not do this again. This is just not a smart way to go about solving disputes. So let's create a new court. And so there was this movement. And that brings us to this other visual symbol that we've mentioned, which is the Peace Palace. That is also on the image for this show, which is in The Hague, the Netherlands. The Hague is a city in the Netherlands. Some people think it's like a building or a statue. No, it's a city, and it's like the sort of administrative capital of the Netherlands. The parliament sits in The Hague, and it also is known as the international capital of peace and justice. And to tell us more about The Hague and the Peace Palace is Taylor, who has spent a lot of time there, and she interned at the Peace Palace, and she was there 7 years ago when the Peace Palace turned 100 years old. So tell us about the Peace Palace, Taylor, and The Hague.
Yeah. So in 1899, during the Hague Peace Conference, they decided they were going to set up the Permanent Court of Arbitration. And it was such a monumental moment sort of in the international justice peace movement, such a big deal. But there was this fear that it wouldn't be forgotten, that people didn't know about it around the world. And this was so important, and it really needed to be marked. It was going to be in The Hague, Netherlands, and the U.S. Diplomat Andrew Dixon White thought that there needed to be this building to house the Permanent Court of Arbitration to really mark what had happened at the 1899 Hague Peace Conference and just kind of be the site of what he called like a pilgrimage for people around the world to really, you know, see what had happened there and to not forget. So Andrew Dixon White wrote to Andrew Carnegie and many other people also were involved in trying to get this started. But Andrew Carnegie was convinced. He gave, I believe, $1.5 million to build this basically palace on the condition that it have an international law library. Because as we all know, Carnegie loved his library. But it adds a lot of symbolism about the power of education also in the peace movement. So the first stone was laid in 1907 at the 1907 Hague Peace Conference. It was finished in 1913. The design was decided upon in a competition. They actually ran out of money at a certain point. But since then, it's really become a tourist destination in The Hague. The Permanent Court of Arbitration still sits there, but it's often known for the International Court of Justice, which is there as well. And then the library grew so large that it was moved outside of the Peace Palace into its own building, but connected to the Peace Palace. And it's still run by the Carnegie Foundation in the Netherlands. And there's so much symbolism throughout this building. Countries gave different gifts. The Nuremberg Archives are there. There are, as we spoke about earlier, with Bertha von Suttner's bust, there are busts all over the Peace Palace of important peace figures. And it kind of tries to give, I think, really light and symbolism to the place of like what this building is about. There's, you know, for example, there's Gandhi and there's all these different people. Before Bertha von Suttner, there was a big statue in the center, which is a whole other conversation. But there's like a giant cross thing to symbolize arbitration between, Chile and Argentina. There's just so much symbolism throughout throughout this building, and it's a really remarkable place, and so many people see this giant building as they're going through trams or they're in The Hague, and they hear about this on the tourist thing, and they'll go up, and I remember being asked many times, what exactly is this for, right? Because there are tourists outside taking pictures. They know this means something. They don't know what it means. And so there is a visitor center, and people go in there, and then they learn all about the peace, the early peace movement. They learn about the Hague conferences, and they learn about the Permanent Court of Arbitration, the International Court of Justice, and whatnot. So it's really incredible that Andrew Dixon White had the, and many others, had the forethought to say, we really need this building to house it and to get people to ask the question about what is this? What does this stand for? And yeah.
Cool.
Cool place.
Yeah. And Randy, do you want to add to that at all?
Yeah, of course. I could talk about the structure for a long time. I'll limit myself to two cool things. The first is, I admit I don't know whether this is still true because of the virus, but the building was open to the public when I was there. And I suspect it still is, so long as you go to the library, right? The library is something that's just you to, you know, you go in and it's a big security guard area. But if you say you're going to the library, anybody can go. And I think there's something so ridiculously profound about that, that, mm-hmm. you know, there's this place that's ridiculously important in the world because it's the house. It's where, like, the UN court is, right, the International Court of Justice. And anybody who wants to can go in so long as they're seeking education, right, because that's what you do at a library, right? And it's so ridiculously profound to me that anybody who's interested in learning is allowed to go into that space, which holds this unbelievable amount of importance for the world. Now, The second piece, Taylor touched on it, and I want to drill into it a little bit more. At the 1907 Hague Peace Conference, when they were deciding what was going to happen with the building, every country commit to putting some kind of art piece inside of it. Every country that was there made a promise to include some kind of, you know, visual symbol of that country's commitment to the peace movement. And so when you go in, there's these enormous, beautiful items that represent each country's commitment to the flag. And, you know, so there's a lot of things in there, and Taylor mentioned a few of them. And it's so interesting because once you know that fact, then you can look at the dates on them, and it's like, oh, wow, the gift from Korea wasn't installed until nearly 100 years later.
Mm-hmm.
Like, why? And then when you start to dig into that, which is what we did during our study abroad there, it was like, oh, there's this rich, amazing history just by studying the art in the building. Mm-hmm. Let alone the building itself, let alone the books in the building, but just the beautiful stuff of the building has a richness that is practically inexhaustible.
Mm-hmm.
So, that suffices for now.
Yeah. Michael, do you want to add anything or have any questions?
Yeah, I guess. I'm like, to hear you all talk about this is absolutely incredible. I kind of feel it's like a disservice to my humanity that I really didn't know this was a place until like mid-March of this year. So I guess it's just like, for the three of you, is there like, if one thing could stick out the most for you all at this place, what would it be? Like, what's the most profound or the most cool or interesting thing about the Peace Palace in The Hague?
Kelly, you want to go first?
I know that's asking a lot.
I think it's the library. I mean, I echo Randy's sentiments. I interned at the library portion, and honestly, before I interned there too, when I did my study abroad in The Hague, I spent so much time in that library writing an independent study paper, and I tried to find like every excuse possible because there's so much rich, like, it's just, there's something so incredible about the thing of that library and the resources available. And then when you go in the basement and stacks, which thankfully because I interned there, I could go, but I would encourage anyone to try to find a way to get a tour. probably shouldn't say that, but it's honestly incredible. It's like a Disney World of international law. Like, I don't even know. It's really an incredible place. There's so much rich history in the basement, so many works that they have, like, and scrapbooks and photos. And honestly, I think one of the, like, Carnegie was so right in that there needed to be that international law library there. That there needed to be this education component, and that it had to be open to the public. I really would echo, like, Randy's sentiments about the power of the fact that it's made international law and peace accessible in a way, theoretically, to people beyond, you know, just, like, something you hear in the news. Someone can really go in and, like, learn about the peace movement and international law, and really kind of, you know, continue on that legacy.
Randy,
So for me, it's odd because with all of that unbelievably rich stuff in every direction, the thing that really stuck out for me was the fact that it's a building, which sounds so simple, but, you know, as a building, there are a lot of things that I really, up until that point, hadn't taken seriously, like the buildings fall apart and have to be maintained. And so every time we're in there, there's a small construction project repairing some tile over here or fixing the window over there. And, you know, there's a kitchen downstairs that provides food to the people who work there. And, you know, the thing that really was just so fascinating to me was that there's an organization in the world responsible for maintaining that structure. And so this idea of continuity, this idea of taking the past and weaving it into the present is something that had to be organized at the same time. And so as I thought about that and spent time in the building, I was blown away by how many things the founders and the creators of that structure thought about ahead of time. And somehow they knew, right? They knew, for example, that there are not, at least on the main floor, like there's no men's bathroom, women's bathroom. There's just two bathrooms that have all the things a person would need. And it's like, that's amazing. They figured it out. They knew that battle was coming. And they just took care of it ahead of time. And it's so amazing. And it's like the little stuff like that. It's the attention to detail of the people who are involved in this movement that were, they were so far ahead of their time, right? And that's the thing that really stuck out for me.
I mean, it's so many things. I just want to, I'm not going to, this is not my favorite thing, but it needs to be said. Taylor did mention the visitor center. That didn't open up until 2012. And I want to just give a shout, like Stephen von Hoogstraten, who I hope will come on our show soon, was the director of the Carnegie Foundation at the time when the Peace Palace turned 100. And he knew, like, I really think that he saw, like, the need for more public education because it's not, although you can get into the library, actually the procedures have changed quite a bit in the last few years. So it's not as easy as it used to be, and especially with COVID. But even before that, it had shifted. But Stephen saw this need to have, like, because so many people would come up to the Peace Palace and want to go inside, and like you can't necessarily go inside. You have to have an appointment, you have to like book a tour, etc. And the response to that was to build a visitor center that's free and open to anyone that allows you to learn. And hopefully once you do that, you just say, okay, I need to go inside. But that's 2012, and that was in anticipation of the centenary of the 100th anniversary. So again, like this education piece, which is really underpinning the show and the role of these objects. And I'll just say, like, the first time I went into the Peace Palace, I was with students from Central Michigan University. And I had just, I knew about it, but I didn't go inside. And we were working at the time with Leiden University, and they were doing our itinerary. They basically planned, like, what we did, and they had, you know, organized a tour for us, and we were just blown away. Apart from, you know, the objects that are inside, the Latin, you know, the messages on the walls inside as well as outside, it's just like, I call it, you know, a nest of stories. And so, Randy, you mentioned, like, you can just look at an object and you go into this rabbit hole of history, like the Korean gift from, I think it was 2015. But there's this, we went in and we were just blown away. And I remember leaving and I said, do you guys want to come back? And they're like, yeah. So I just, like, you know, not working with Leiden, and I just like made another tour. And I remember telling someone at Leiden University that we went back to the Peace Palace again. And this is a Dutch person. And that person said, why on earth would you do that? And I said, have you ever seen the Sistine Chapel? That's exactly what I said. Like, hello, like you can't just go there once. And I have found that even people in The Hague, so we may have an unrepresentative sample because we interact with people who go there, right? Like they're already there. They're already on the grounds. But during the year of the centenary, where I was just doing all this crazy stuff in The Hague at the time, everyone I interacted with, you know, taxi driver, you know, vendor, every single person, I would use that as an opportunity to educate and figure out if they knew what was going on, and they didn't know what that building was. And they lived in The Hague, you know, and I would say, okay, did you grow up here? How long have you been living here? And there's just total ignorance. So the best that, you know, the Carnegie and Andrew Dixon White can do is put up an object that, you know, hopefully speaks to you and causes you to say, what is that? And that's what happened to me, you know. That was, I think, in 2011 when I first went inside and learned that Andrew Carnegie built this thing. I had no idea, you know. There's a lot of people in the United States who have no idea of this part of our history. We've talked about this on our May 18th show. So I just want to give a shout out to the work that continues to be done in educating the public through the visitor center, because I think a lot of people get sort of turned towards this part of history that they had no idea about. Anything else to wrap up this segment of our dialogue? Going once, twice. So I'll just to transition to our next section. I'm just going to read this passage from a letter from Andrew Dixon White to Carnegie, Andrew Carnegie, that Taylor referred to. You can find this on the Wikipedia page for the Peace Palace. And P.S. I'm the one who put it there, but it says, "Were such a fabric to be created, men would make pilgrimage from all parts of the civilized world to see it. It would become a sort of holy place, prized and revered by thinking men throughout the world. The main difficulty now is that the people of the various nations do not really know what was done for them by the 1899 conference, but such a building would make them know it. It would be an outward and visible sign of the court, which would make its actual tangible existence known to the ends of the earth." And so there was a multi-year campaign to get Andrew Carnegie to give money to build this thing. And so this was one of the appeals. There were letters. They went to go visit him. So that's part of the campaign. So I want to focus on part of this letter that I read, again, to repeat, if you don't build this building, right? And the thing, I should mention this, like Taylor mentioned the 1899 Hague Peace Conference, that this did produce this new court, a permanent court of arbitration. But the court was operating in a kind of rundown, like it had a physical location, but it didn't scream Temple of Peace by any means. It was just like a nondescript building on, like, it just nothing symbolic about it whatsoever. And some of the participants in the conference were quite upset that the permanent court of arbitration was placed in such an unassuming building, and we need something more symbolic, because if you like do this, if you don't take this seriously, no one's going to know what was done for them. So this will make them know it. Well, it's not entirely true given my experience, because even though people see it every day, they don't necessarily know what it is. So it takes some effort on the part of the person. But this goes to the ignorance piece and the fact that we are, you know, ignorant about this story, this movement, which I will argue, you know, is still continuing to this day, that there is this connecting thread from this movement to where we are now. But this education piece is really, really important to that movement. And this is something that we did stress in the May 18th show that I mentioned earlier. And so I'm just going to, like, make the claim here, then we can talk about it, that absolutely the Peace Flag and the Peace Palace, insofar as they are concrete things help the movement. And I just, I'll start with Taylor, and we'll just go around alphabetically. Can you talk about, Taylor, how, like, these physical things, either the Peace Palace or the Peace Flag, help the peace movement today?
I think it's that entry into the forest. And, you know, beyond, like, that we've been talking about recently and throughout, I mean, throughout this, throughout the podcast, but I think that there are so many symbols, and it has to be that sort of piquing of the curiosity, like, what does this mean? Why is this here? And we've sort of been left sort of, I guess a good analogy would be like a treasure hunt throughout history of our, you know, these stories that would otherwise be forgotten, and there are symbols left so that people can begin to ask the questions. And they're, it's not maybe forced down their throat, right? Like, you get, you have to actually be curious and start asking questions, but it's available. And you know that there's something there and that it means something, right? With every flag, we know that there's a story behind that flag. And with every building, there's going to be a story behind that building. And so when you hear something like the Peace Palace, I think it's natural. And you see this giant, actual, literal palace. You know that a royal family doesn't live there. You know, there is, you know, why is that there? Who built that? Oh, it wasn't built in the Middle Ages? Like, what does this mean? It doesn't look like a normal palace. Or with the flag, you know, it is so unique. It's a peace flag. Why do we have a peace flag? What is it used for? And so it creates, like, these questions, I think, in people's heads. And, I mean, I've seen it with your, you know, your research, Hope, when you find new exciting things. You know, one breadcrumb leads to the next breadcrumb leads to the next breadcrumb. And I think it allows for, like, these places of inquiry and these points of inquiry, and you can kind of go sort of your own path, because no one person is going to know everything, but it allows someone to know some part of everything. Not like each individual will know some part of the story, and then collectively we can remember it.
That's really cool. And Michael?
From everything that I've come to know about it, I really love that idea of, and I think it's so profound, that the Peace Palace sort of serves as this pilgrimage, as it was described, in this beacon to draw people into the realm of the peace movement and stuff. Because you have religious pilgrimage sites that draw millions of people from around the world, from Jerusalem and Israel to Mecca and Saudi Arabia. You have sort of knowledge-based centers, Library of Congress in Washington, D.C., symbols of enduring love like Taj Mahal in India or the Eiffel Tower in Paris. But for the peace movement, which is so profound on its own, to have its own physical location that people can go there. And I love that whole idea of people going and they see this building, they really don't know lots about it. Like Taylor said, it sort of serves as that entry into the forest that you can come in, like, through your purpose of seeking knowledge. And I think that is so profound. And that all of this iconography with the flag helps to serve to further that message, that this is what this represents, all the symbolism behind it, so profound, from the gender dynamic to this overall profound message of humanity sort of up on this upward track towards trying to realize these very profound goals. And I think that is just absolutely amazing.
Cool. Randy?
So, along with the flag, one of the things that we've mentioned in the previous show, which there was a small badge made, which is basically like a tiny flag that you pin to your body, right? The Universal Peace Badge. We talked about it at length in the previous show, but basically there's this idea that you can take the symbolism from that flag, from this idea that's above you in the sky, and you can put it onto your body. And for me, the key to that is that there's this individual component to peace work, which is not external. And the big external symbols provide this dichotomy for us, you know, it's sort of built into the fact that, okay, here's an enormous symbol that is unlike any other symbol around, obviously big and there. And then behind it, when you start to dig in and incorporate some of the meaning into your knowledge, into your understanding, and then into your personality, it starts to dig itself in, burrow, so to speak, into your behaviors. And this universal peace badge is something that you can incorporate in order to consciously do that work. And it's this other side of peace work that I'm so, I guess, infatuated by, compelled to continue doing something, such that, like, the more work that a person does creating a peaceful landscape inside themselves, the better that they're able to participate in that kind of work externally in the world. And there's this internal transformation process that tends to be packaged into religious language, and there's this monopoly on that part of the human development that somehow gets segregated from secular life. And the peace movement and the symbols associated with these things, these enormous buildings and these enormous ideas, smash down that wall between the spiritual component of life and the secular component of life. And it's no, you need to bring these ideas together and build a bridge. And it turns out that that bridge is through the center of the human heart. It is the individual. And these symbols, they force that understanding over time. And it's so amazing to me because it worked in my life, you know. Here I am pointing out that this occurred and is continuing to occur. And it's so useful for me just to, like, I'm looking at it right now, right? It's sitting on my desk, the same pin that I've worn over the course of 7 years on and off in order to remind myself to live up to the golden rule. And it's like, once you do that and you start to bring the peace idea into your own life and into your own personality, it starts to transform your life into the kind of place where peace is possible, and it stops being an ideal. It stops being something way above you in the sky, and it starts being right in front of you. And so for me, it's like these symbols, they make it real. They make it real.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Anybody want to add anything else? No. So if I can try to just crystallize what we've said, because we're coming to the end, and I'll try to segue into our next show, which happily is very much connected. But we've talked about this educational function, right, that these symbols allow you to enter the forest of this story, and that in addition to that educative function and just making you aware of this, to implement these ideas in your own life so it's, you know, could be transformative for the individual, not only because you're learning about something you've never heard of, but also the golden rule, which is very much at the center of the device, the Universal Peace Flag of 1897 and the badge that Randy has talked about. And as he mentioned, we do discuss that in the May 18th show. And I want to say that to sort of tie everything together and also point to another direction that we have not yet discussed, but we absolutely have to. Oh, at the beginning of the show, we were talking about yesterday, which is the 100th anniversary of the 19th Amendment, which grants women the voice in the laws under which they live. And little known is something called the International Council of Women that was organized in 1888. We could do many shows on this organization, and I think it did come up in the May 18th show, but I just want to mention this organization because their constitution, and by the way, Susan B. Anthony was really instrumental in the formation of the International Council of Women. It was formed in 1888, which is the 40th anniversary of the Seneca Falls movement, which is customarily regarded as the beginning of the women's rights movement. So by 1888, they realized we need to organize internationally, that the suffrage thing was not just a U.S. issue, it was an international issue, just like slavery was an international issue. And the International Council of Women is functioned very much like the Universal Peace Union that Randy talked about earlier, which is like it's this hub. And it's this hub of all of these different women's organizations, temperance, peace, equal pay, abolition, all like racism, human trafficking was in there. So this is this huge organization, and I just want to point out their constitution. The constitution, I'm not going to read the whole thing, but just this is a part of it, that the sort of we are banding ourselves together in a confederation of workers committed to the overthrow of all forms of ignorance and injustice and to the application of the golden rule to society, custom, and law. I think we could do a whole show on that one sentence, the overthrow of all forms of ignorance and injustice, not just one form, all forms of ignorance and injustice, and the application of the golden rule to society, custom, and law. And that application, and the self, that's the point that I want to connect with, because Randy, you're talking about that these symbols, they invite you to work on practicing the golden rule at the individual level. That is what the Universal Peace Badge is all about. And I'm just pointing out that this organization in 1888, which did use the peace flag, consciously bands together to apply the golden rule to every aspect of society and to overthrow all forms of ignorance and injustice. Any comments on that, where we are like winding down because it's an hour, but any comments on that as we're sort of, going to slowly wind down the show? Going once?
Yeah. I mean, very briefly, it's so important. And, I have a habit of trying to state the obvious, and I'm going to do so now in order to reinforce it. But, individuals are part of a society. The society is just a bunch of people. And when you start to be the kind of person that you would want to populate your society, it turns out your society gets a little better because you're part of it. And, it's so simple, but, you're the kind of person who you have to spend a lot of time with. And so things like the golden rule force a person to confront the parts of themselves they don't perhaps like. And it's weird how fast that starts to happen when you try to actually live in the world according to this principle. But once you do, which is what the physical symbols help us do, you start to see how difficult that is. Mm-hmm. And I think it's so useful to know that making yourself into a better person is really hard. And if that's hard, changing society must be ridiculously hard. And to imagine that we could just fix it by, a quick piece of paper to a quick organization that changes one rule of one organization and it's just going to clean it all up, it's just ridiculous. Mm-hmm. And so it's pointing to the difficulty of how this is a process that's going to take generations. And that provides a useful frame so that we can start to work on the hard problems in a way that's slow and careful and deliberate, which is exactly what the people started for us many, many years ago, and are represented by the Peace Palace and represented by the Peace Flag. So it's like this work has been going on for a very long time. We are part of it if we choose to be. We can continue to be part of it if we want to be. And all it takes is the commitment to a principle. And in this case, the golden rule is one such principle upon which we can commit and become part of this lineage that's that's making serious work towards peace.
Cool. Anybody else? So
what Randy talked about kind of reminded me of what Susan B. That quote that Susan B. Anthony said after she had seen the peace flag, that as she motioned towards her heart, the first person to begin this work of peace is right here. And I really love that component of changing your internal landscape to better yourself as an individual, and then put that out into the world in the hopes that then others will do the same and advance your society in a positive direction. I thought that, like, to cap that out, that was really profound.
Yeah. Yeah, that's awesome. And I'm going to end here because I think we mentioned at the beginning of the show that, so tomorrow is August 28th, and so it is the 107th anniversary of the Peace Palace, and it's the 57th anniversary of the I Have a Dream speech. And we are still, you know, working on the peace thing in for ourselves and in this country. And August 28th, and I must credit my friend and colleague, Andy Blom, who visited the Museum of African American History in Washington, D.C., and learned that August 28th is like an important date in African American history, not only because of the Martin Luther King I Have a Dream speech, but for other reasons. And I'll play this clip and say that this year is the first year that we will have August 28th without John Lewis, who died, as Randy reminded me, on July 17th of this year. John Lewis was there on August 28th, 1963. He was inspired by Martin Luther King when he was 15 years old. And I think that it's really important to remember him and some of the lessons that he has bequeathed to us. And I hope that next week we focus on some of those lessons. But for now, I'm going to play this clip of Ava DuVernay, who made the film Selma, which includes, you know, John Lewis as a young man at 22 years old. You'll see him in the trench coat with the backpack. And so this is Ava DuVernay in an interview. And so if you haven't seen Selma, now's the time to watch it again, if you have seen it. But she was commissioned by the African American History Museum in D.C. to make the, like, intro film that all people who walk in to the museum first see, their sort of, like, introduction to the space. And she's called it August 28th, and this is a clip where she's talking about it.
So the film is called August 28th, and on August 28th, I was an African American history major at UCLA, and I'm just a history buff and geek. On August 28th, a lot of really, truly amazing things happened in African American history, but they all fell on this date in different years. So on August 28th in one year was the abolition of slavery in the UK, which started a trickle-down effect and led to American abolition. On August 28th in another year, Emmett Till was murdered, which was the flashpoint of the civil rights movement, as you know. On August 28th in another year, Martin Luther King made his I Have a Dream speech.
I have a dream. My four little children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. I have a dream today.
On August 28th, another year, Katrina made landfall.
Katrina blasted into New Orleans, the most powerful hurricane the Crescent City has seen in modern history.
August 28th in another year, President Obama accepted the Democratic nomination for president.
With profound gratitude and great humility, I accept your nomination for presidency of the United States.
All all on August 28th.
Wow.
So, yes.
I never realized that.
It's called August 28th, and these amazing actors came together to make this film. We made it over the summer. Everyone from David Oyelowo and Lupita Nyong'o to Don Cheadle and Angela Bassett, Gugu Mbatha-Raw, Regina King, Michael Ealy, Glenn Turman, great people.
Mm-hmm.
And we tell those stories.
So if you had still been shooting August 28th this year, you would have had an addition to it.
August 28th this year. And I always track the date because there's usually something interesting.
I'm going to do that too now.
Yeah. A couple of years ago, it was around the time of Ferguson. Like, you know, it maybe had been going on for a few days.
You must disperse immediately. This is no longer a peaceful protest.
Nothing was particularly on that date, but it was during that time when all eyes were on Ferguson. This year, though, on August 28th, was one of the first press conferences that Colin Kaepernick gave about his decision not to stand for the national anthem during NFL games.
I'll continue to sit. I'm going to continue to stand with the people that are being oppressed.
And he spoke very kind of eloquently and passionately about his choices, which, you know, could have fit so nicely into the August 28th movie about athletes and activism and dissent and protest and our rights and how we exercise them. So the film was already done, but maybe there'll be an addition in later years.
So that was a clip, I think that's in 2016 that she's talking. And if you just Google Ava DuVernay on August 28th, you can watch that interview. We will end it there and pick up this discussion next week, these connecting threads. You've been listening to Virtues of Peace, and what will happen on August 28th this year. We'll reflect on that next week. And peace, everybody. Bye-bye.